And welcome, everybody. Greetings to all our listeners from around the planet. Nice to talk to you again. My name is Henrik Palmgren. This is Red Ice Radio, and you can follow us regularly at redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com. We have a big roundtable for you guys today with some of the speakers that are attending the Paradigm Symposium this year. All of our guests have very long bios, and a lot of work behind them as well. But I think we should get started pretty much right away, and you can learn more about our guests as the program progresses, if any of the voices are new to you. So I hope you enjoy. Okay, welcome everyone. Thank you for coming on. We have an interesting discussion, I think, ahead of us here. We're going to try to distinguish some of the properties of our past, where we come from, and at the same time as we move forward in the discussion, we're going to try to argue basically how we can move ahead into the future and compare it to how we've lived before. We have seven guests with us today, and I think this is a record for Red Ice Radio here. And I think we should welcome them on one at a time, so you, our listeners, can get a chance to hear who we are talking with here. And some of you, of course, might have heard some of our guests before on this or other programs, and some might be new to you. So I think we should begin here in no particular order here. Robert Boval, thank you for coming back. Good to talk with you again.
It's a pleasure.
Really good. Robert Schock, welcome to you as well. We've had you with us before also.
Yes, it's a pleasure to be back. Thank you.
Very good. Then we have Scotty Roberts, one of the organizers of the Paradigm Symposium. Welcome, Scotty.
Thanks for having me.
Very good. We also have Marie D. Jones. I've known about your work as well for some time now, so it's good to talk with you finally, Marie.
Well, thank you. Thanks for including me.
You bet. Then we have Micah Hanks. Welcome, Micah. Thank you for joining us as well here today.
Well, it's very much my pleasure, Henry.
John Ward, who jumped in the last minute here. Welcome, John. Good to have you with us as well.
Good evening. Thank you very much. Thank you.
And then finally, we also have Laird Scranton. Welcome, Laird. Thank you for coming on. You've been with us before as well, so good to talk to you again.
Yes, thanks, Henry.
All right, well, I think that's everyone. Is everyone there? Yeah, I think so. I wanted to obviously begin to discuss our past, human civilization, and maybe as far back as the dawn of consciousness. There are a lot of missing pieces, I think, in our world today that we maybe not use or understand from our ancient world. And I thought, Robert Boval, maybe we can talk with you about this, considering your work into beginnings or the genesis, if you will, and ask you if you think that our place, if you will, in the universe has changed, if we have fallen outside of it, or if there's something from the ancient past that we simply haven't incorporated into our world as well. How did ancient man, live, and what is it that we're missing today, Robert? What would you say to that?
Wow, what a question, Henrik, to start with. Oddly enough, I was on the radio yesterday to a radio station in New York, and we actually talked about this point. You know that I'm very centered on ancient Egypt and its prehistoric past. I have always believed that Egypt, rather ancient Egypt, and very early Egypt, is a model. It's an ideal model that sustained itself in a very harmonious way, in a very creative way, and peaceful for several millennia. So to me, ancient Egypt isn't just something we study in the past. It's a civilization that could be used as a model. I'm not suggesting we go and wear kilts and build pyramids, but they did have a system which was ideally suited for the people that lived in this geographical location. They called it MAT, the cosmic order, and I've written a lot about this. I won't go into detail, but that's what I think. I think that there is a lot to extract from the ancient Egyptian civilization that can be useful today.
Indeed. Robert Schock, if we turn over to you a little bit, you've also talked about this, of course, in the past, compared a lot of things coming out of Egypt, but you've also more recently looked at places in Turkey like Göbekli Tepe and some other sites around. I guess from your point of view, as I remember it, Robert Schock, you feel that there is a warning, I guess, from the past as well, that there's something we can kind of learn from when it comes to that, correct?
Yes, I think that's a very good way to place it, to put it. Something that I've been working a lot on is looking at the past and looking at something that I think we miss in the present, and that is looking at long-term cycles, long-term effects, long-term really history. I think something that is a detriment, and Robert Bouval in a way just touched on this, you have, for instance, Egypt, you have other civilizations that lasted for millennia, literally, and we tend to be very short-term. We tend to think in terms of the next election cycle here in the United States. And I think that's something we really need to learn from the ancients, and it's one of many important points, is to think in terms of the far past and into the far future, to think in terms of centuries, in terms of millennia, in terms of looking at major cycles, which I believe we can map out and do exist and sort of are part of the cosmos. Being very specific, for instance, I've worked a lot recently on the end of the last ice age, and the site that you just mentioned, Göbekli Tepe in southeastern Turkey, which dates back to about 10,000 BC, which is straddles essentially the end of the last ice age. And we see at the end of the last ice age essentially catastrophic changes that the ancient people at that time suffered, that they had to experience. And I'm talking natural changes in terms of course, the end of the last ice age, but what I believe were solar outbursts that brought about that. And there's good geological and isotopic and other data to indicate that, but there were major, literally major earth changes. And this is part of a natural cycle that I, as a geologist, have been studying, but many people are very short-sighted, have a very compressed view of history. They think of, you know, things even 100 years distant from us or 100 years into the future as being really out of the range, out of the boundary of their everyday thinking. And I think we have to correct that. So that's one thing I would mention.
Can I jump in here just a sec?
Sure.
I'm going to jump in, as you say. Yeah, I mean, the point of this long-term thinking is, as Robert Schock said, is very much in line with the ancient Egyptian civilization, and of course other civilizations that were running in parallel. And the pyramids are a perfect example of this. I mean, the pyramids were not built for the next elections or for 100 years. There were monuments that were built for a very, very long period. They thought in terms of millennia rather than, like Robert Schock says, rather than short periods. And this is what we have to learn from them, is that they seem to have had a very stable idea about their civilization.
Yes, exactly. I would say a very stable idea about their civilization, and also the concept I would throw in when you look at ancient civilizations in general over terms of thousands and thousands of years, that there are periods of stability, but there are also periods of change. So another thing that we have is things like the Yuga cycle from the Hindu culture or the processional ages in a more Western view, or the classical concept of the Gold Age, the Silver Age, the Bronze Age, the Iron Age. So I think there's two themes here. One is long periods, looking at long temporal durations, long periods of stability, but also periods of change, in some cases, essentially catastrophic changes, where civilizations seem to end very catastrophically, new ones pop up very quickly in some cases, or at least the beginnings of them. So I think there's two aspects here, but they both involve very long-term periods of time. And that is something we need in modern times to be learning to think about once again.
Right, long-term as opposed to the short-term kind of path that we're on right now.
Exactly, and as I just mentioned, as a geologist and someone, as we all do, looking at ancient civilizations, short-term, I would include within short-term even just a couple of hundred years or even 1,000 years. That's really, frankly, short-term.
Yeah. Laird, I wanted to tie into this as well. I mean, you've been looking at the Dogon and some other, you know, civilizations as well that seems to be very different, if you will, than from ours. They have a different set of mythology and everything else. But what's interesting with your work is that you've found basically echoes in their teachings as we've kind of met up with them right now with our modern scientific knowledge. Tell us a bit about that, Laird.
Well, what's interesting to me is that the cultures that I've studied that seem to be the most stable are the ones that didn't adopt what we consider to be certain advancements, like the ones that never adopted a system of writing. For example, the Dogon don't have a traditional system of writing, seem to have done a much better job of preserving the tradition intact. And that seems counterintuitive, but it's a demonstration of how very stable and very self-supporting the original model was.
Despite our having the idea that Rome is where, you know, our civilization is built, or the Greco-Roman kind of period, Laird?
Yes, I mean, the Greco-Roman are just a shadow of what the Egyptians and some of the older cultures are representing. And I think they understood that. And it's clear when you start studying the other traditions that there's a couple of thousand years of history before that that's as important.
If I could jump in here really quickly to put things in perspective, I was mentioning Göbekli Tepe in southeastern Turkey. I believe you and I have talked about this on other shows. There you have incredible sophistication, and it dates back to about 9,000, 10,000 plus BC. So that's a gap of about 6,000, 7,000 years prior to the beginning of dynastic Egypt. And so, again, I think this is part of, you know, these traditions go very, very far back, and there were declines, there were falls, there were reemergences, but we really need to think in long, long terms.
Could I jump in there?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead, John.
Just for many of you who are aware, I am actually currently sat on my dahabir on our site at Gebel El Sesila, which is south of Luxor, ancient Thebes, and north of Aswan. And I'm currently sat on the deck, and Scotty knows more than anybody. I'm actually staring at the Speos of Horenheb, the pharaoh Horenheb. But what is more pertinent to your discussion is today, actually, of all days, we've been cataloguing and documenting the pre-dynastic or the prehistoric rock art that is located here in the southern end of the west bank of Sicily. And this morning we started off at 5:30 in the morning, and we walked from the 18th or the end of the 18th dynasty with Horenheb. We then went back in time and we went to the quarries of Hatshepsut. From there we proceeded westwards, and we were entering the workmen's huts. They were the actual quarrymen themselves who lived in the area, and they worked in the quarries. And we walked through their inscriptions and their graffiti and their broken pottery shards and their stacked stone hut affairs and so forth, walking in their very pathways, you know, walking in their footsteps. We then continued southwards, and as we continue southwards, we're going back in time even more. And as we get into the deep south, we start to enter the more eroded areas of the Sicilia mountainside, And there we find these small little caverns and so forth dotted around the area, which is lined with graffiti and inscriptions dating from dynastic period, but most importantly is the prehistory stuff, where we're getting into the prehistoric rock art, where we have geometric shapes, we have the very, very basic boat motifs that we can find all over Egypt. And what I'm trying to get to is that from 5:30 until 2:30 this afternoon, when we were completely dead on our feet because of the sun and the heat, we were actually able to walk not just over 25 kilometers, but we had walked through a time period that spanned just over 9,000 years, if you count the 2,000 years that we're in at the moment. And we got back to around about 7,000 BC or thereabouts. And all of that is encapsulated in this one small area. And for those of you who are familiar with Gebel El Sesila, it's two outcrops split by the Nile. And the Nile itself, during prehistoric time, cut its way through the gorge and produced the two mountaintops, one on the east bank and one on the west bank. And to me, that is fascinating. So listening to Robert talk about Göbekli Tepe, Lard knows we've been having emails going backwards and forwards on this very subject. But today, I thought it was quite pertinent to share that with you, that especially with all seven of you here present, sharing with you that, you know, we've walked literally in these footsteps of not just the ancients, the Romans, the Ptolemies, the dynastic chaps, but we've also been in the hunter-gatherers, where they've emerged out of the what was, or what is now, sorry, the Sahara Desert, but was then a lush, green environment. Exactly what Robert's saying, the climatic change brought it to, not an abrupt end, but it brought it to a gradual end where their resources dried up, literally, and to seek further shelter, security, warmth, food, etc., 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 they came closer to the Nile's edge. And what is more important, of course, is with these hillsides is that they are above the flood line. So during the inundation where the Nile would creep up much higher than it is today, of course, the Aswan Dam, we still have preserved these wonderful monuments up on the hillside.
I'm going to jump in. I have to, as you probably know. I've studied rock art in the Western Desert, in the Gilf Kebir and Jebel Weilat, with Tom Brophy, my colleague and co-author. And I'd be very interested, John, if you can bring or send me some pictures, because I'd like to compare this rock art that you have in Jebel Silsila with the rock art that we studied in Gilf Kebir and Jebel Weilat. As you know, I've written two books on this subject with Tom Brophy, Black Genesis, and now just came out our book Imhotep the African. So I'm very, very interested in this rock art that you've seen. I haven't seen the ones at Jebel Silsila, so please bring it over.
I can see what I can do for you, Rob, once we've published.
Oh, come on.
But I myself, I've been down to the Gilf Kebir, and as you know, I've cataloged and documented the migration now of symbolism from its origins here in the Nile Valley, so to speak, across the Western Desert, the Gilf included, going all the way right through all the different Darbs, all the trade routes, be that the Darbar Farafra, be that the Darbar Bain, and so forth, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Ah, great.
And going all the way through to Siwa, and then up into the Mediterranean, and across onto mainland Europe, and so forth. And again, that doesn't just confine to geographical locations. That is, again, encapsulating a time period, and as you've just mentioned now, Robert, you know, we've got rock art throughout the whole of Egypt, or the whole of Northern Africa, let's be honest, and beyond, which is phenomenal. There's so much of it, and if we only took the time and the effort to analyze the data and the material that we have to hand, it would be just amazing bringing it all together under one roof and just looking at it. And it's wonderful. Today has been an absolute joy. It's been a pleasure and a privilege to walk in these footsteps of these guys and ending up, as I say, down in the deep south, where even today we've got a little village that's popped up. It's occupied by the Nubians, who were unfortunately made homeless during when the Aswan Dam was open. And they've made their home here, and they've got their mud brick homes down at the bottom of the ancient quarries. And, you know, they've actually incorporated part of the quarry face into their homes and so forth. And it's wonderful. It's a continuation. It's not encroachment. It's not something where they've been damaging anything that's antiquity or so forth, but they've actually made it their home, and at the same time they've preserved it. And that, I think, is a symbiont relationship between the people, the land, and the history. And it's just wonderful to see it there.
Mm-hmm. Now let's take a little round the table here and let some of our other guests into the discussion as well. I wanted to begin with you, Marie, and ask you about some of your most recent work. We talked earlier about basically that this has been forgotten, or that we have, you know, no longer a connection to this, you know, despite that the evidence being there, and just as, you know, John described, of course, that it is there for us to see. But the other idea here is that we also have mythology. We have other, you know, aspects in our life today where this knowledge has been passed down. It's very much alive and still active. It's just that we might not have this perception about it. What can you say about this, Marie?
Well, I'm really new to this party, and I'm just in awe of these people and the research that they've done. And the angle that I have come at which sort of came by surprise with this book, Viral Mythology, because I'd not done a lot of this kind of work before, was just my love of ideas. And I wanted to know, even today, because I think what happens to us today can be extrapolated to what went on in the past and what will go on in the future. Now, if you look at us today, how does information get spread? How does it go viral? How do certain ideas and concepts and innovations take off and become contagious, even, you know, globally, and others don't? And I wanted to know how that happened in primitive times and in ancient cultures as well. So the idea is there's all of this information out there. We're trying, these guys are trying to take the clues that are before them, whether it's in the form of art, rock art, cave painting, you know, more elaborate art, whether it's in the form of architecture, and that can include monuments and edifices and even more advanced architecture, and also story, mythology, fairy tales, folklore. Who's trying to tell us what here? That's what I wanted to know. And I'm curious as well, as I know these guys are focused a lot on the physical clues. I want to know, what were these people, what were our descendants trying to tell us? And how can we discern that based upon the information that actually made it to 2013? You know, what was left out? What was hidden because the authorities would not approve of it? What did we misinterpret? Because even today, we misinterpret information. Why did certain ideas go viral from ancient times to today and others just didn't take off? So that's the kind of angle that I'm coming from. And again, I just am absorbing like a sponge everything that these guys are saying, because it all has to do with that sort of viral spread of information over history.
Right. If we switch over to, well, I think both Scotty and Micah might have another little take on this, and I'm not sure, you guys have to clarify that for yourself, of course, but are there other elements in human past that can, you know, explain some of the potential longevity, shall we say, of certain civilizations that was past? What if we begin with you, Scotty, anything to add to this, what we've been talking about so far, and do you have another take on this?
Well, I am rather like Marie in the sense that I am a newcomer, relatively so, in the last couple of years to studying these fields a little more intensely, other than just basic history. I look at the tagline on your own website and you say you're questioning the artificial constructs. And that is what I have engaged in. That's why all of these people that are here today are people that I've gathered around myself in one form or another, and why they'll all be speaking together with us. And I see it this way. I was raised in a background that was very focused on one religious point of view when it came to creation and the existence of mankind in the past. And of course, being in a more or less fundamentalist type of setting, very conservative, religion that I was part of also denounced anything that smacked of anything different than a biblical or a scriptural source point for anything. And that is what over the last 30 years has led me away from that, to question and to ask more. I've written three books now that deal with the types of things Marie is talking about, the type of work that both Robert Schock and Robert Bevall and Laird Scranton are working on. John Ward and I just wrote a book together, and this topic that we dealt with deals with these things from a different standpoint. It's looking at stories that have become legend, religious legend, even religious mythology, and trying to decipher the mythology from the historical and find out why does that story from 3,500 years ago still exist today, and what has happened to that story over the years. So once again, hailing back to your own tagline, I want to question the artificial construct. I want to know what is artificial, what is man-made, what is there something real out there as opposed to what we have made it to be? And so that is my take really on all of this as a generalization.
Very good. How about you, Micah?
Well, you know, Henrik, something that I've found in my personal experience is that there's so much ideology that goes into people's perspectives on reality, whether that be the reality of ancient history and the mysteries that we're confronted with, or the reality of today. In my own research, I'm primarily best known for UFO studies these days, and that is something that, of course, I'm very passionate about. But by the same token, I spent a lot of time over the years studying ancient mysteries just as well. There is a certain continuum to it, and I think that one of the emerging hurdles that I have encountered, whether it be study of ancient mysteries or modern mysteries, across the board you're going to be confronted with people who will try and attack any approach that is outside the norm. And funny enough, I try to be fairly conservative with my approaches to studying things. I'm often very comfortable with calling myself skeptical. And yet, even when I try to present a very logical, conservative argument about an ancient mystery, I tend to find that there is an ideological sort of skepticism that comes into play that is often, if anything, not only questioning the validity of an extraordinary claim, but at times also, if anything, a bit of a denialist ideology. To give an example that kind of fits into the scope of this conversation, and also coming back around to something that Marie pointed out, she asked in relation to her research in her latest book with Larry, how does information go viral? And I love that question because certainly we have myths and we have legends. And I think that it is a common assertion that these myths and legends maybe point to some physical element in our culture, in our spirituality, in our ancient past, perhaps and often maybe more than not, that it is something that has been lost to us. And so while we can look at the physical aspects, as Robert and Robert do, we've got two of the finest Roberts, I think, anywhere on this panel today, by the way. When we look at these ancient mysteries, there is both that physical component that we can go out there as archaeologists or researchers and try and find, and then we can cross-examine that with that viral mythological component. For me, it was very interesting when I began to look at Native American legends here in the United States, because I'm very close to the Western North Carolina Cherokee Reservation. And of course, having grown up in this area, I've made a point of spending time on the reservation, getting to know, Cherokees and also learning about their mythology. Something that you'll find a lot of are stories of fairy folk and little people. Something you find far less of is mention of giants, and yet there is one compelling legend that shows up in Cherokee mythology that I've referred to as, it was first referred to by the anthropologist James Mooney as the story of the giants from the West, in which the Cherokee told this incredible tale of, humans of large stature that came and spent time with them, specifically probably around the Western North Carolinas and Southern or Western South Carolina. This would have taken place centuries ago. Ideally, of course, this would have also been in pre-Columbian America. Now, what's interesting is that in the record, both the geological or rather the anthropological record that is maintained by the Smithsonian, as well as in various newspapers and things over the last couple of hundred years, there does seem to be some compelling evidence for the existence of humans of very large stature that kind of corroborates with these Cherokee legends. And yet, again, when you try and address this subject in a very logical way, you look at the actual Bureau of Ethnology reports that the Smithsonian have kept themselves that describe sometimes giants in excess of 9 and 10 feet tall. It's very interesting because the two responses that I get from the more skeptical community are that, A, well, but there have been humans that are that tall who have existed in Earth's history for a long time and still today, and that's nothing that is anomalous. And furthermore, most of those reports are probably overblown or there was bad science being employed. Again, I think that even if we go back to the 1890s, that's not always the case when we look at Bureau of Ethnology reports. These were probably the most accredited and experienced experts in the field at the time, and they weren't trying to hide anything. They put right there in their reports, Cyrus Thomas and many others, they discussed openly the discovery of large skeletons and referred to them as such, in, again, a very conservative and scientific way. I find it very strange that we have evidence of things, and that if you attempt to discuss these things and say and ask questions and say, well, it is interesting that there were such large people in ancient America, that, again, a typical modern skeptical attitude is, as my colleague Scotty Roberts often points out, they will respond simply with, that's not anomalous, no, it's not, no, that isn't. And I think that, again, that there's compelling evidence where we find this kind of parallel between the mythologies, where the Cherokees, for instance, said at least in one instance they were visited by giants, and then the actual physical traces of humans of large stature. I think that the point also has to be made that maybe we can observe this phenomena without having to say that this was a separate race of giants. And one of my real problems is that if you try to even talk about this, people assume that, first of all, A, you're asserting that this is a separate race of beings that existed apart from humans, and therefore that this was, of course, something that goes not only completely against conventional approaches to history, but I've also found that many in the skeptic camp will also call you a racist for even addressing these subjects. As bizarre as it sounds, the research that Robert Bovall does here, where we look at the component in ancient Egypt that involves black Africans and their influence in that culture, it is viewed in very much the same way. And how is that anything that is, if anything, racist? It's absurd to me. It's the antithesis of that. And so I think that what we often see is that if you try and bring an alternative approach to this sort of research, if people disagree with you so strongly, and then you present really good evidence for it, even in a conservative way, then the criticisms and the attacks begin to be launched, and you're called a racist, or you're called a creationist, or God knows what. And it's really unfortunate that this is a prevailing attitude, even today, as open-minded as we like to think of our scientific establishments. So for me, again, I think it's important to look at both the mythology and the physical evidence, but present it in a way that is clear, concise, at times conservative, and that is conducive to furthering the lesser acknowledged elements within this field.
Can I jump real quick?
Go ahead, Marie.
Just real quick. One of the things that really struck me, you guys are going to laugh and think this is funny, but this is just how my brain works. One of the things that really fascinated me about information and ideas was this recent showing on the Sci-Fi Channel of this god-awful movie called Sharknado. Now, you guys probably didn't watch it because you're all involved in much more serious pursuits, but what happened was there was a phenomenon created before this ridiculously awful, cheesy, stupid movie aired on the Sci-Fi Channel, in that the pre-buzz for this movie was so insane that it literally toppled every other topic on Twitter and Facebook and what have you. And I was watching all that while I'm finishing up with Larry Viral Mythology and thinking a lot of what happens to us today in the present really can give us some insights into what happened in the past. So this ridiculous idea that just took over literally the country by storm, and even had people like me watching, because I was just fascinated by how quickly it went viral. It got me thinking about fiction and the mythology of today. Our mythology of today is in motion pictures and novels, and television shows like The Walking Dead and Falling Skies and Mad Men and what have you. And really what is happening is that fiction hides truth. There is a lot of truth in fiction. It's not like nonfiction where you're laying out facts and statistics and backing them up with information and what have you, but there is still truth in there. So it really frustrates me when people say, well, the myths of old and the religious stories in the Bible and other holy texts, those are just stories. They're just fiction. They sat around and they made them up. I don't think that's true. I think just like the fiction writers of today, there is truth. And it's our job, all of us, in whatever way that we've chosen, to try to figure out what the heck that truth is that's mixed in with the storytelling.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, mythology is the original sci-fi, and as I see it, and there is some pretty pretty extravagant stuff coming out through the mythological record. Go ahead, Marie.
No, I think you're right. And had they had Comic-Con in those days, all of the gods and goddesses would have been attending. So definitely, it's just fun to watch how things work today and then try to see if that also applies to the way things operated in the past.
If I may just add one little thing to this. When I wrote about the reptilian notion, if you will, I compared it to the ancient mythology of the reptilians. It's been morphed into the current day mythology. If you go and look up that topic, an ancient alien type of reptilian race, and you start examining that just in the social networks, you look at it on the internet, and you will find so many accounts, hundreds to thousands of them, that mimic each other almost verbatim. You could say plagiarism if you could actually find a literary source for any of them, which you can't. They sourced it somewhere because they all have pretty much the same story, but they keep retelling this story. And it is a reworking of ancient mythology, which in many cases, doesn't have a lot to do with what the original mythology was all about, but that's where it's built. So that morphing of mythology in from the ancient times into current day mythology is an intriguing thing to follow and watch.
If I can make a quick comment about giants and small people.
Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, this is Robert Schock. And I wanted to mention first off that I've been working in Easter Island also and researching that and been there a couple of times. And there they do have legends of giants. And this is, you can interpret it as you want, but they describe them as about 10 to 12 feet tall, depending on whether it was males or females. And this is a very persistent legend. It was recorded in the 18th century when the Dutch and other European explorers first came to the island. And I wanted to mention in tandem, the Dutch, who were, of course, in the Dutch East Indies, now the area of Indonesia and Java and that whole region, they recorded also legends at that time of very small people. So this is 18th, 19th century, that there were supposed to be these very small races of people that would come down from the hills and raid the villages. They were recording what the natives told them. And this was absolutely dismissed by, you know, modern scientists, modern anthropologists as, you know, just mythological nonsense, as we've been talking about how so many myths are dismissed. And people may have heard about Homo floresiensis, which is now a subfossil human species, a distinct species of humans that was found only based on fossils in the early 21st century. You know, within the last 10, 15 years, the fossils were found, I think first described in 2006 or so. And this is a distinct species of humans. At first, many conservative scientists and others wanted to dismiss them as simply pathological individuals, more or less, you know, diseased individuals because they only stood about three and a half feet tall. The subfossils go back to about 10,000 years, which is very recent geologically, especially given the preservation effects in Indonesia. And there, I think we have to now look at these so-called myths once again in this particular instance, that maybe this species, this distinct species, existed right up until the 18th, 19th century. In fact, it's not totally inconceivable that from a cryptozoological point of view, there might still be some surviving members on some remote island in the Indonesian region. This is, I think, a very good example. I even use it with my students at Boston University of how myths are dismissed. And in fact, in some cases, very good hard physical evidence appears that then seems to support exactly what was being said in the myth.
Schock, let me ask you about the, you know, the statues that we have then on Easter Island, and many people still think that actually are just stone faces, but these are actually entire, you know, giant statues. I mean,
all of the statues on Easter Island, the Moai, these huge statues, what they are is their big heads and their torsos. They go down to just below waist level. They tend not to have legs, but they do have torsos, they have arms, they have heads. There are a couple that are kneeling and actually have the legs. A lot of people think of them as only heads because many of them are buried in sediment up to their chins.
Does it mean that they actually were standing on top of the soil at some point and they've just simply sunk down, or,
They were standing on, this is something I'm researching right now. They were standing on top of the soil. All the indications are that they were erected on the soil and that not so much sinking, but that soil has filled in around them. There's no evidence in a single case so far that they were purposefully buried, but in fact that they had been erected on the soil and then it's filled in around them. And it seems not, from a geological point of view, it seems not to be catastrophic filling in. More or less, it's not tsunami. It's not huge landslides, because that would have knocked them over. So it seems to be a gradual filling in around them. And there is some question, in my opinion, and this is an active research project, some question as to how old they are. And I think that, like other things around the world, the Easter Island statues, at least the oldest ones, because they were made over a long period of time, I believe, the oldest ones go back much further than the conventional mainstream archaeologists would lead one to believe. Right now, they're dated at most to about 1,500 years ago, and I think that we're really looking at a culture on Easter Island that goes much further back. And also, the connections may be with both Polynesia to the west and South America to the east. So I think there's a lot to learn there.
How should we interpret, do you think, you know, Robert Chalk, if we continue on that a little bit, the stature of these statues then? I mean, are we talking about giants? Is it a real mythology, if you will, a live story?
The Easter Islanders in their legends, when you talk to them to this day, they stand by many of their legends. They say there were actually two groups of people, if you want to call it two races of people on the island, the long ears and the short ears, which are also distinguished by their size, their stature, with the long ears being larger overall, and the long ears supposedly were sort of in charge of things and introduced the carving of the Moai. At one point, there's a revolt of the other race against them, and they talk about a huge war on the island between the two. But yes, they take it very seriously. There's one native Easter Islander, Rapa Nui is what they call the island. One native Rapa Nui I know, he's an artist now, and he told me in no uncertain terms that he had seen large human bones, ancient large human bones on the island. And it's very tantalizing. I asked him, are you sure these are not animal bones, you know, cow bones or something else? He said, no, he's an artist. He knows what human bones look like. And he was absolutely convinced, and he's told me this, you know, privately, that these were absolutely ancient human bones of large, we'll even say gigantic stature, you know, on the order of someone that's standing, you know, 9-10 feet or more tall.
Huh. Well, fascinating. I think we should take a little, again, around the table and give out some websites, and you guys can mention some of your latest work and everything. That's there's a lot to talk about, of course, and it's always difficult to squeeze 7 people into 45-minute segments like these, but let's do that. And then I wanted to ask Scotty a little bit more, of course, about the upcoming Paradigm Symposium and everything else, but let's go back to you again, Robert Bevall, and maybe you can just mention what you're working on right now and give us your website.
My website is robertbevall.co.uk, and I've got several books in the oven, as they say. Imhotep, the African Architect of the Cosmos, has just come out a few days ago. Available on all the normal outlets and Amazon. I've got a book on the Vatican called The Vatican Heresy, which I've co-authored with a Italian researcher. Surprisingly, even though the title is implicit of a Vatican investigation, it deals with ancient Egypt. So that's what I'm working on. I'm actually in the process of writing a book with Ahmed Osman, a follow-up to my book, Breaking the Mirror of Heaven. It's called Egypt Unveiled, The Quest for Mat. We're in the early stages, and the delivery is due in a couple of months. So there you are. That's my thing.
All right. Very good. Very good. Robert Schock, how about you?
Well, I'm always working on things, and let's start with the website. My website is www.robertschock.com, and just so people can spell it correctly, my last name is spelled Schock, S-C, well, it's pronounced Schock, but it's spelled S-C-H-O-C-H, so Robert, S-C-H-O-C-H, all run together, .com is the website. My latest book, which I hope everyone will take a look at, is Forgotten Civilization, The Role of Solar Outbursts in Our Past and Future, and as Robert Bevall said, it's available on all the usual outlets, websites, Amazon.com in the U.S., for instance, or around the world, but Forgotten Civilization. And in there, I do discuss a number of topics, including some of my work on Easter Island, of course, my work in Egypt on the Great Sphinx and Redaying the Great Sphinx. I include a chapter on Göbekli Tepe and a number of other topics, including my views on the Last Ice Age and what brought the Last Ice Age to an end, which I touched on briefly previously in conversation.
All right, very good. Thank you for that. Laird Scranton, I remember last time I asked if you had to set up a website. I think you didn't, but this time you have one, correct? You've set one up now.
Well, no, actually, it's a fan site.
Ah.
It's a pretty good fan site.
Ah, okay. Yeah, it looks good.
There is a www.lairdscranton.com. I can also be found at my publisher's website, www.innertraditions.com. And I also maintain a public presence on Facebook. A lot of times fans who want to contact me through Facebook. Presently, I have a manuscript on ancient Chinese cosmology at the publisher with Inner Traditions. It'll be out sometime this year. And that has laid a foundation for a symbolic foundation, a rationale for the structures that we find at Giza and why they are placed the way that they're placed. And I've been working on that concept with Ed Nightingale, the master woodworker from Pennsylvania, who spent done such good work on reverse engineering the plan of Giza. And I've also been doing quite a bit of study in relation to archaic symbols and words that might connect places like Egypt or the Dogon or Buddhism to the very ancient site, Göbekli Tepe.
Very good. We have a few left here then. Marie D. Jones, let's move on to you.
Well, my website is mariedjones.com. My website with Larry Flaxman is paraexplorers.com. And we've got together two books. We have one coming out next month called The Grid, Exploring the Hidden Infrastructure of Reality, coming from Hampton Roads Publishing. And in January, we have Viral Mythology. And, oh, gosh, the subtitle for this one is long, but it's called Viral Mythology, How the Truth of the Ancients Was Encoded and Passed Down Through Legend, Art, and Architecture. And that'll be out on New Page Books. Starting 2014, I have several novels coming out, so I'll be getting into fiction. Storytelling, combining truth with fiction.
Very good, very good. Okay, well, we have a couple more left here. Micah Hanks, let's move on to you. Micah Hanks, sorry.
Absolutely. Well, you know, in addition to co-planning Paradigm Symposium with Brother Scotty, and I'll let him tell you more about all that. Of course, that's an ongoing joy. There's a lot of hard work, but I mean, the best parts about it are, of course, getting to come together and talk with people like all of you. And of course, I'm so looking forward to seeing all of you there in St. Paul in October. But additionally, of course, I'm hosting a radio program called the Micah Hanks Program, and also doing a podcast that's called The Graylian Report. And there are two websites. All the information about all of that is available at those two sites. The first one is just my name, MicahHanks.com. And then there's Graylian Report, which is Graylien Report.com. And this may be the first place publicly during an interview that this has been mentioned. But my upcoming book, which is out actually on Kindle as of yesterday, and the print edition is going to be coming out on available through Amazon.com very soon. It's actually something, Hendrik, you'll probably find interesting because it has to do with its origins and I think where you're from. It's called The Ghost Rockets, and it looks a very unconventional aspect of ufology that very little has been written about. And I maintain with this book that not only were there these ghost rockets, these strange projectiles being seen in parts of Scandinavia immediately after World War II, but those kinds of reports still continue today. It's a bit of a departure from the kind of ancient mysteries and things we'll be discussing at Paradigm Symposium, but then again, my interests, as is the case with most of the folks present here, are pretty multifaceted. But that's what I'm up to right now.
Very good. John Ward, you still with us? Do you have a website you can give out?
Oh, hi, guys. Yeah, I'm still here. No, I mean, the best place to catch me is on Facebook. Living out here and working all year round, I don't get time to do my websites and so forth. So the best place to catch me is on Facebook and the Gebel El Sisila Epigraphic Survey Project on Facebook. And we've got our blogs, our name in. You'll find us all over the place. And all of our work that we do here in Egypt with symbology and Sisila and everything else.
We'll make sure to have that Facebook page up as well for you then, John. No problem. Okay, well, let's move on then finally to Scott Roberts, and we can get the skinny of the upcoming Paradigm Symposium as well.
Sure thing. Well, I've got a lot of irons in the fire, and of course the Paradigm Symposium is the biggest red-hot iron right now. Everybody that's talking here on your show today is going to be part of the Paradigm Symposium, as well as several other authors. It's taking place in St. Paul, Minnesota, October 17th through the 20th. Now, you can see everything there is to see about the Paradigm Symposium at paradigmsymposium.com. However, for your listeners alone, for Red Ice listeners we have a private page set up that only you will know how to get to. Just simply go to paradigmsymposium.com/redice, as one word. And you will see the identical page, but we have special pricing for you at the bottom of the page. You get 20% off if you buy one ticket, 30% off if you buy two or more. So you can go to that page and avail yourself of some Red Ice only exclusive special ticket prices. And again, that's October 17th through the 20th. Now, I have a new book of my own coming out with Dr. John Ward. It is entitled The Exodus Reality. And John, being a British archaeologist living there in Luxor for many years, he and I for a few years had toyed with the idea of writing this book. And we have two distinctive views on Moses and the Exodus. And this is what I referred to earlier as going into mythological or legendary religious stories and trying to find, is there something efficacious to the history there? And so this book presents our ideas on this topic. And you can find me personally in many different ways. It's just funny the amounts of non-privacy I have anymore because of all the websites I have and all the phone numbers and all the things. But my personal website is simply my name, scottallenroberts.com. And Scott is two T's. Allen is A-L-A-N. I didn't know till recently how many different variations of the name Allen there are out there. So scottallenroberts.com. And you can find me on Facebook and on Twitter. And you can find all our efforts. Also mimicked at Micah and I work together with Intrepid Magazine. So just go to intrepidmag.com. You can find links to the symposium, links to Micah Hanks, his radio shows, links to Dr. John Ward and I do Intrepid Radio every Sunday nights. Find it to all the books and the Paradigm Symposium, everything at intrepidmag.com.
All right, very good. Guys and gals listening, then check out that page on paradigmsymposium.com/redice for a 20% off there on the tickets. That's very nice of you. Thank you for that, Scotty. I do believe all our listeners who are going to have plans of going there, of course, are going to appreciate that. So that's really good stuff. And we'll have all the links up, of course, that all of our guests have mentioned on the website as well. So if you did forget one or whatever, we're going to have them up there for you just to click through. So let's take a short break here then, everyone. We're going to continue and talk more in the second. And thank you for all your patience as well, as it does take quite a bit for everyone to get in there. But this is good stuff. So everyone, stay with us. We'll take a short break and we'll be right back with more.